Dennis, thank you very much for introducing me, and it's an honor for me to be here at SAP to do the Salon SAP, or SAP Salon. In terms of my background, I have always been very interested in data. I did my undergrad in Karlsruhe, which is, you know, the university closest to SAP headquarters, and that was in EE and in physics. And why then did I move to other areas? Those days, physics clearly was where the most interesting data were to be found. I then did my PhD at Stanford, starting off in physics, but moved from physics to what's now called data mining or machine learning, neural networks, to systems that learn from data. I ran in the early 90s at Xerox PARC and the Santa Fe Institute a time series contest where we put a few data sets out and asked people around the world, pre-web, my friends, around the world to send in their predictions, how those data sets continued, and learned, created metadata about that. Then I was assistant professor in computer science, associate professor in information systems at NYU, at New York University, at the Stern School of Business, where I did a lot of work with financial institutions, because in the 90s, the interesting data was clearly in finance. Then this thing called the web came along, and I started my own company called Mood Logic. And in some sense, I'm still impressed that within 2.5 years, we had 1 billion explicit ratings of songs. What we did is we put up on the web a platform that allowed people to tell us what they think about individual songs, not whether they like them or dislike them, but, for instance, whether the song has a soothing character or whether the song is sort of energizing them and the right thing for workout, for instance. So 2.5 years, 1 billion explicit ratings. That will be a theme throughout my talk here. I then went to Amazon.com, worked with Jeff Bezos in understanding customers, and the whole notion of being a customer-centric organization, where for me, customer-centric, as you can tell by now, primarily means end users. A customer-centric organization really is reflected in many, many small details, like the metrics in an organization, for instance, employees, and permeates throughout the entire organization, through the mindset of every individual customer. I then left Amazon in 2004 to do those things which I enjoy best. One is teaching. Within the last 3 weeks, I started off my data mining and e-business course at Stanford. It's in statistics and management science and engineering. A graduate level course, about 80 students who just come to learn about what's cool, what are data sources, and what we can do with them. I'm teaching just a one-unit course at Berkeley at the Haas School called Marketing and Web 2.0, which tries to understand what are the implications of those new data sets for marketing. Marketing is no longer companies, you know, publishing PowerPoints and running ads on the Super Bowl, which are carefully crafted by the minute, but these are conversations which are happening anyways. And can we do something about the noise? It's just the permanent, it makes hard to consider. Actually, the door opens all the time.
I'll do my best, but I can't promise it.
Okay. So it's about conversations which are happening anyways among customers. And that's a new course Berkeley taught, which within half a day had the 70 seats signed up. So there seems to be genuinely some interest of people trying to understand what is the relevance for potentially large companies. The MBAs and the MBAs there come from all walks of life. And the third course I'm teaching is I teach in China. I've been in China since 1994. A course at Tsinghua and INSEAD, which is called basically the digital networked economy, which tries to understand what are the implications for organizations of, you know, what I call and what I'm going to talk about here today, the new consumer data revolution. So don't think of it as a talk. I really would like to have it much more of an interaction. And I told Dennis, I would just like to sit around a table with a few people, have a conversation with you. But then, you know, he said, oh, no, no, if you have a hearing, you have to have it for a larger audience. So I'm happy to be here, but I do ask you to interrupt me and to help me understand, figure out here what it actually is that the implications are. Part one, the old data revolution. For me, the old data revolution clearly starts at, you know, the days of early Amazon.com. I've learned that in Switzerland, you have a retail research center. And RFID, similar to Metro's Future Store near Düsseldorf, near Neuss, RFIDs, of course, are a very powerful way of creating internal transparency in the organization. And I've worked with Metro Group. And the example I always think about is when I went there, checked out, you know, the store, every individual packet has a radio frequency identifier, costs 2 cents, about 2 millimeters large, and walk by the lab and look at this cream cheese, but then I put it back and I go for the low-fat version of the cream cheese because, you know, I figured a couple of pounds to lose is not a bad thing, as, you know, probably many of us think here. And then I walk on in the aisle, and suddenly the dieting pills start blinking at me because it, of course, knows that I just looked at that cream cheese and put it back and got for the loaf. And now the price is actually not fixed. They pride themselves by having displays that only take energy when you change the prices. So as I walk by, the prices go up by 40% because from a past history, they know I'm not that price sensitive. And as, you know, Dennis might be walking by, they say, you know, if we get him at marginal cost, you know, hey, we're selling him something. So, and then I'm checking out. Actually, no, there's no checking out anymore because, of course, it knows everything I put in my cart. As I'm just walking through with my cart, now one of the big questions arises, namely, what about all that information? Should I, as I throw it in my hatchback car, have all these RFIDs still be right there and readable so some other guy who might have an RFID reader can, you know, just simply check out what I have and decide it's not worth breaking into that car because of, you know, a couple of pieces of cream cheese and some dieting pills? Or should I actually erase that information and then be in that information, in that situation which some customers found themselves in the European Union, some Amazon.com customers, who requested their purchasing history be erased? They just bought, you know, a toothbrush, I think it was. And then the toothbrush broke like 2 days after they bought it. And they call back, and of course the only answer is, what toothbrush? Because it's very, very hard here. The point I want to make is that what we are envisaging of a future, and I could spin this out much further, of retail, already was day one at Amazon.com. Because in order to actually send you the page about the low-fat cream cheese versus the normal-fat cream cheese, Amazon knows what you clicked at. So those digital traces, and we're in part one of the talk for those who came later on the old data revolution, those digital traces, which we leave everywhere, really originate, I think, and brought it to the most obvious forefront of our thinking in e-business. Let me walk you through some of those information sources, some of these data sources. So far, I've talked about click data, and actually the homework set I just set to my Stanford class, the second homework set here, was that people make themselves a good old-fashioned website and figure out what is happening, what are the HTTP refers, where are people coming from, and then overlay it with Google Analytics, which truly has an amazing amount of precision. If you have a class of 50, 60 people, you can actually tell if one person lives in Fremont when he comes to your class. The second thing is with Yahoo Pipes, which some of you might, it used to be that I have to write a crawler, which goes out and looks at Craigslist, and then Craig Newmark told me that's okay, but in general, you're violating the conditions of use here. So this year, we're doing Yahoo Pipes, which is totally trivial, how you just string stuff together, and you want to know how you can find a one-bedroom in Palo Alto for maybe less than $3 million or whatever the prices are here by now, or maybe it's down to $1 million again, then, you know, you have in this world of RSS feeds, very different paradigm. Instead of going to crawl, somebody's pushing it out to you, and you just need to filter it. You actually have something even useful. I hear the students don't use it for the $3 million homes. They use it for dating. But, you know, it's just adding, changing a few parameters there. So that is the first source of data. Let's go a little bit further. I believe that the intention economy we live in has reached a relatively mature stage. What do I mean by intention economy? Search is the way how we are publishing our intentions. And you know, the Google company over there, Mountain View, clearly leveraged with a couple of $100 billion market capitalization relatively well, that if you tell Google what you're interested in, Google knows what ads to show to you. So that's a relatively new idea, if you think about it, comparing it to, you know, not having information about the individual and about the situation of the individual. Now, I tell Google I'm interested in pizza, and they say, hey, you know, there's a Domino's pizza down the road in El Camino. So that's the intention economy. What you don't know is really where people's attention sits. So after the intention economy, I like to talk about the attention economy. And that means that one of the scarcest goods which we have actually is our attention. So I'm actually very grateful for you to give me your attention here. And if we can measure, if we can instrument the world we live in, right now not so much instrumenting the enterprise, which was the example of the retail store or the future store Metro Group has, but instrumenting, for instance, the browser or the mobile phone, then let me give you some examples of what my attention stream consists of. It consists of course, you know, the difference between long clicks and short clicks. Most of the sequence of the web goes Google somewhere, Google somewhere, Google somewhere, Google somewhere. So if you know reduce the web history, it's basically that. Now, Google somewhere. Google somewhere, Google somewhere. So the first somewhere we actually spend some time on is, of course, a very different positive experience, unless I just made myself a cup of coffee, compared to the Google somewhere Google, where I didn't want to actually be at the somewhere. So long clicks versus short clicks. Forwarding something. So if I, for instance, use a newsreader, such as Atenza's newsreader, which is used, for instance, Cisco uses it, within the firewall, and leverages the attention stream of others to help bubble up stuff which you might actually not see otherwise, which you might miss otherwise, to you. And then you can forward things to others. You can save something to yourself. You can annotate it. You can delete it. You can subscribe to a feed. All of those are attention gestures the user provides. Why? Not to help Atenza or to help Google or to help the RSS author, but to help themselves. So one learning about the attention economy is that people are getting good and doing things where they feel that down the road they profit, their attention stream will be actually better off by sharing those things, in this case within the firewall, with the system. Because if I don't do this, then I can only get an unconditional probability distribution of what interesting articles there might be. If I do share this, then there are chances that the system gets better and better over time. Let me give you an example of a company which does it poorly. Zagat's. Zagat's, you probably know, is the restaurant guide. And what I answer in response to a certain restaurant has no effect on what I see down the road. So there is no benefit of my truthfully talking about the lovely food and the bad service, or the lovely service and the bad food, or whatever it is. So it doesn't help being honest versus being dishonest, being non-truthful. And that's not how you collect good data. In the music example, MoodLogic example, MoodLogic, by the way, was sold to AllMediaGuide, which was sold then to MacroVision. In the MoodLogic example, the clearer and crisper people actually answered the questions, the better their experience was down the road. And side remark, it really does depend on how you ask the questions. For instance, we experimented with asking people, so what do you think about the quality of the voice? Versus, how do you think others think about the quality of the voice? So basically taking out themselves and their idiosyncrasies and sort of putting themselves in more of an average mind. And we experimented with the little incentives we gave. We didn't pay them. But the little incentives was, if you are close to the mean of what people are saying on a 5-point Likert scale, we give you more points than if you are one of the outliers. So people now think about, you know, I don't really matter. What will other people think and what will be the mean? And you get much cleaner data that way. Sometimes these small things in the data collection which we do across the world, in the framing, make a big difference. So that is intention data and attention data. And I think the key in this attention data, and we are still talking about the first consumer data revolution, is trying to get people to actually have the future depend on what they give us now, because that way we get honest data from them. Some other examples of this, you know, old data revolution are location data. One of my clients is Nokia. So there's Nokia Research just down here on Patmore Road. And then, of course, Helsinki. By the way, the brand recognition of Nokia is bigger than the brand recognition of Finland. You know, Finland is the country in which Nokia sits. So that's actually quite interesting. So Nokia will be shipping 100 million mobile phones with GPS this year. So as part of this old data revolution, think about businesses like MapQuest, which was bought for $8.2 billion by Nokia last year in the fall. MapQuest used to employ 1,000 to 2,000 people who drive through the country with GPS devices in them, and that way they measure out the streets. 1,000 people. It took them about $300 million to get to break even. 1,000 people. Compare this to 100 million. 1,000 to 100 million, that's five orders of magnitude. Factor of 10,000, a factor of 100,000. Physicists, you know, only the zeros count. A factor of 100,000, so square root of 100,000 is like 0.3%. So you can measure things with an incredible accuracy. If you just track where people are driving anyways, you might miss some sort of military, you know, Sperrgebiet, whatever you call this in English, you know, where you're not about to go to. But probably the maps don't really matter in those areas, because if you don't want to go there, if you can't go there, maybe other people can't go there either. So that is still the old consumer data revolution, the old data revolution, that people have their stuff tracked. People are willing to have their what are sometimes called implicit data or their passive data pooled together for, you know, the hope of getting better products down the road. Do you have any remarks before we get to the second data revolution? Do you have any remarks on that area? I could go into more data sources here, but I want to sort of start the discourse a little bit, emphasizing that I'm not a corporate guy who thinks about knowledge workers, about who people who get paid to, you know, measure things and enter it in computers and stuff like this. I know that, you know, that's very important for SAP users. I've never used SAP in my life, willingly or unwillingly, I'm not sure. Amazon had PeopleSoft, that's my only experience with sort of such software. Any remarks on the first data revolution? Yes. A question which always comes up is the question about the bias, and I have to disappoint you, there is no perfect answer. So what happens is that if you try to do a poll, whether I hear there's an election later this year, and you want to know, this year, next year, this year, or has it been already? Not yet. No. So there are people who try to sort of predict the outcome of the election. And they use the same technology for the last 50 years of trying to find sort of representative samples, stuff like this. That is one problem, but that's not the problem where, you know, I'm going to help. I had a problem set last year in class, which went into that direction a little bit by saying the University of Michigan and Reuters conduct Consumer Confidence Index survey on a regular basis. And I read that the consumer confidence is down at the level it was at 82. It has not been as low since 82 as it is now. So, and they send this out, I've heard, to 5,000 people. 5,000 people. And what we did last year is we looked at the data from a company called Hitwise. Hitwise has relationships with ISP, Internet Service Providers, which allows them to look at 10 plus million individuals in the United States with persistent history. And if you observe the behavior of 10 million people in this country and know how their search terms, for instance, shift over time, implicit data they provide, not because they want to help Hitwise come up with a better consumer confidence, but because they want to know how much is my house worth, or eBay buy versus eBay sells, or maybe used cars versus new cars. Or, I mean, think about those things, where people actually provide us with so much information in more or less real time, which sending out letters to 5,000 people will never get us to. So back to your question here. Yes, there are always biases. And the question is, do we have some ground truth somewhere? In most cases, we don't. But what choices do we have? And my choice is always, hey, let's actually look at what we have and see how we can make sense out of it. From a scientific perspective and from an action-driven perspective of companies, my answer is a very different one. And that is that the bottom level indeed is the data substrate, is the data level. But for companies to make decisions, and that could be as trivial as whether a certain button at Amazon.com should be on the left or should be on the right. For companies making decisions, the right way is to first think about what is your action space. So, for instance, I worked for a couple of years as a consultant with Swiss International Airlines and did the online strategy, and I'm doing something similar with Lufthansa right now, the German airline. And there it is really coming up with good ideas, coming up with creative ideas. This whole thing is a creative process where you design possibilities, where you design actions, and then you just run experiments. If you need 3% of the customers, you pick randomly one digit of your frequent flyer number, and you assign this digit, you know, if it's a 1, 5, or a 9, then you're in the group which sees that experiment. All the other people actually see, you know, the other, see the default. And so the question about biases in the online world is tends to get removed by saying, let's do experiments in parallel, where we randomly assign people to group A or group B, and then hopefully everything else will cancel out. It's different from predicting elections. Any other questions about the data? My RFID example.
Actually, I have a question. So the question is about, now you're talking about the collection of the data, right? What about the operationalization of the particular data in terms of, you know, you collect this huge amount of data, right? How do you operationalize it in terms of, you know, how do you search it? How do you manage it? How do you, store it? All that kind of stuff.
Okay. I'm not very popular with CIOs because I always tell them that storage is free. I say, but we have to do backups. Well, you know, and basically storage is free. I just ordered last night a 2 terabyte RAID with UPS and power supply and stuff like this. The thing puts you out $1,000, $2,000. And now, estimates are that the entire web is, you know, between 10 and 100 terabytes, the surface web. So it is not hugely expensive. Bandwidth is not free, but storage essentially is free. So sort of the read one systems actually do have their space in the world. From an operationalization perspective, similar to what I answered in response to the gentleman's question before, that if you think about what actions you can take, and you then just do the experiments and just look at a set of metrics, maybe 5 metrics or 10 metrics, which I'm not thinking about the old kind of metrics like page views or unique customers. Who cares for unique customers? We care about customer-centric values, metrics. For instance, you know, how many products have I reviewed, how many articles have I forwarded to my friends, and so on and so forth. So those metrics, you measure then if you have action A and if you have action B. So I am not particularly worried about the plumbing. I'm worried about the creative process of asking the right questions, and asking questions means, and I think German philosopher called Hegel said this once, that the scientists ask the questions and the nature just answers with yes or with no. So any other comments on this first data revolution, on the amazing spectrum what we have seen? And nature. Nature answers with yes or with no.
I don't want to take you too far afield, but you've talked about intention and attention. And is there work that's been done around causality from one to the other? So whether it's psycholinguistics, the way in which someone may parse together a string of words trying to accomplish something, depending upon the order in which those words are put together, may produce somewhat different results, which causes them to land at a particular spot that they may not have by following a different path.
Good. So the question about causality always comes up. And although I'm a physicist by training and I love building models, I have actually very little to say in this context. The one insight I have to share with you is the following. Let me go back to the example which I just had, which was the example that, let's say you could have something on the left side or you could have something on the right side. And let me show this to you, actually. So here is an example of, you know, Amazon's page, and then somebody clicks this button and, you know, we need to be future compatible, so I always have my slides translated in Chinese right away. So this here means add a shopping cart. And then, of course, it's like playing a game. That means I just made a move, and now Amazon makes a move, and Amazon is thinking, what should we do? And decides, okay, we want to show the customer the shopping cart we had, and, of course, we need to show the context of that. And then actually turns out that about 20% of all revenues come from the next page of Amazon, namely from recommendations. And recommendations come in two flavors. One flavor is here compliments, stuff which you buy in addition to what you are buying already. And the other one are substitutes, things which you buy instead of what you are thinking of buying already. And then I say, okay, we put this page together. And now the question here, I get to causality in 1 second, is should we have this blue bar I constructed on the right-hand side, or maybe should we have it on the left-hand side? And now, you know, whenever, in whichever continent I talk about these things, people, of course, immediately start, well, it depends on whether people read from the right to the left or the top to the bottom or from the right. And the answer is it does matter. So causality in some way is taken out of the game. What you agree on a set of metrics, and here the metrics example is the conversion rate, the visitors actually ordering stuff, and or another metric would be the order size, how many items, or it could be the margin or the profit or the revenues. I mean, you agree on these metrics. Another creative exercise, getting a rich set of metrics together. And then it turns out that here when we run the experiment, having the shopping cart on the right-hand side is about 1% better than having it on the left-hand side. But it is actually a very interesting thought that you don't have to worry about why it is the case anymore. If you just have the rigorous methodology of basically testing everything. And this is an absolutely, I'm the first person to admit this, totally trivial example I gave you. But let me give you another example, which is a company I work with which does hotel bookings. Company is called Agoda. They have 30, 40,000 hotels in Asia. So if you want to go to Asia, go to agoda.com and book your hotel there. And the problem they have is you enter Bangkok, that they have maybe 500 hotels in Bangkok. Don't know the number. Now, which of them should they show on top? Because you're certainly not going to click 50 pages with 10 hotels until you make your pick. And then things get interesting, that you have different algorithms in the background which figure out, all reasonable algorithms, reasonable parameters, which figure out what you should be able to show in this user. And then they have very smart ways of comparing, of basically horse race, those algorithms against each other all the time. And the role of creativity here is to come up with yet again new data sources and with a solid set of metrics, and then the machine runs itself. So this is quite different of, you know, trying to come up with physical laws and explaining things, hey, ultimately people want to make money. And there are short-term effects, there are long-term effects. Long-term effects are much harder to get to compared to short-term effects. All the effects I've told you about right now are short-term effects. Long-term, you actually need to track customers over time and see how the behavior changes. Not easy, because, of course, the overall behavior of the internet population is changing. And the people who grew up, I have one student in my class who actually wrote in his first homework, when he was a kid, he was playing with Ajax. So I went, you know, what I was playing with when I was a kid. So people are now freshmen. They grew up in a very different world from, I think, all of you, as far as playing with Ajax is concerned. Yes, there are lots of non-stationarities, and ultimately those effects go away after a certain amount of time. You probably know the Hawthorne effect. Does anyone know the Hawthorne effect? So when you run these short-term tests based on the first set of data, going to land in a second and go to the second set of data, you find that if you change something, people's attention goes to this and performance goes up. The experiment was done in Hawthorne in the Detroit area where they make cars. Do they still make cars in America? Yeah. Okay, they used to make cars at least for 100 years ago, and they found out that people weren't performing as well as they hoped, and then they cranked up the lights, and voila, performance went up for a while, and it was back to the baseline level. So I said, well, might as well save the money, turn the lights back down, and performance went up again. Because people felt attended to. So, hey, somebody takes care of me, you know? And people, something changed. So lots of the effects you see online are sort of these effects that just because you show something else, people notice it. One area of research which I think, at least as far as end users concerned, has a huge impact, which is just barely getting noticed by companies, is behavior economics. And an example, my friend Dan Ariely, who just came out with a book called Predictably Irrational, a great book, great guy too, gave me was that he ran real students. I don't know whether the country has been revealed. Real students who he gave electroshocks. And the first group of students were given painkillers, and they were told, you know, that's 50 cents painkiller, drop one, and, you know, in 5 minutes, we'll start the experiment. The other ones were given painkillers. These are $20 worth of painkillers. Yes, really, really good ones. And it turned out that objectively, although these were identical painkillers, the second group could withstand higher voltage electroshocks. Another example here is when you show options in these recommendations that it sometimes happens if you add or take away an option which nobody chooses that you still reverse the behavior in the rest of the set. So I want to give an example from a publication which I personally think very highly of called The Economist. And The Economist used to offer three possibilities. And one of those was that you get an online edition, just an online edition. The second one, you get online and your print edition. And the third one is that, guess what? You get only print edition. So they ran that, and they measured how many people go for online, how many people go for online and offline, and how many people go for offline only. Now, what I didn't tell you is that the online plus offline was the same price as the offline only. So here is the screenshot from The Economist. So online only $59, print $125, print and web $125. Result was that 16% choose this one and 84% chooses print and web. Nobody, I guess people who read The Economist are sort of smart. Nobody. So they said, okay, might as well remove this option. Probably somebody got, you know, pay raise for, you know, removing the option. Now what happened? It flipped. It used to be 60 in this, 80 for this, and it became 68%, two-thirds of them, now went for the online only, and only one-third went for the print edition. Isn't that fascinating? How removing an option nobody chooses changes the behavior. So I leave it to your imagination what, you know, Amazon.com has used for all kinds of experiments where we introduce some option in order to, you know, flip you from this to that.
The petroleum industry understands that because we have three prices for gasoline. And they always want to get to the
thing. Yeah. Who actually buys anything but the cheapest gas? I always buy the cheapest gas. You buy one person in the room. So marketing still works for one out of 100 people. The last example I want to give you, because it might actually be relevant for some of your end users who use SAP machines. And that's an example of organ donations. So here are countries, and the percentage was, what percentage of drivers are willing, you know, if they have an accident, to have their organs donated? I'm not talking about those cases where people, you know, get, you know, hijacked in China and then, you know, their kidney gets sold on eBay and stuff like this. These are, you know, Western European countries. And look at this. In Germany, 12%. Austria, 100%. It's just interesting, you know, similar religions. I mean, are just Germans so much more selfish? But anyway, when you're dead, you know what, it doesn't matter. Or let's see here. Denmark, 4%. Sweden, 86%. How is it possible? And these are significant population size, 100 million people. Square of 100 million is 0.01%. So these are small error bars. The answer is some graphical designer, you know, who gets paid $50,000 a year. He, you know, needs to make a decision. What's the default? And that has an impact in the billions onto the health in these countries. So the power of default is extraordinarily important. And, you know, in this case, in your case, it, of course, is not a graphic designer. It's a very well-educated knowledge worker, alpha, B, or whatever. But still, don't underestimate the importance of default. Final example is complexity, and that's something which actually I don't know where we stand on the web.
Are these actual numbers?
Oh, totally actual numbers, absolutely, yes.
And in those countries, that's 100% by default.
Absolutely, yes. So I thought it was obvious that those countries have as a default set that, you know, in California, you need to put this orange thing on your driver's license. So the default is that you're not an organ donor. So I would expect California to be over here. But in Austria, Belgium, France, Hungary, Poland, Portugal, Sweden, the default is you are an organ donor unless you remove something.
So in that case, then the Swedes are the most, like, they're really looking at the question.
Yes, yes. Reading, I hear literacy rate is quite good in Sweden. Okay, the last point I want to address, because I think it's an important point in interface design, is the question of complexity. Example one. Done right there on the road in Menlo Park at Dräger's. Dräger's had a promotion, and on one day there were six kinds of jam on the table at Dräger's. And some random shoppers, i.e. students who, you know, get paid, you know, $3 an hour to sort of check out what's going on, some random shoppers were carefully counting. It turned out that 40% of the people who entered Dräger's went and checked out one of these germs. So 40% is the rate of people who actually showed an interest in those six germs. Out of those 40%, the so-called conversion rate, namely those who actually go and buy within a week using a $1 off coupon, at least one of these germs, was 30%. So this is conversion, and this is sort of people stop by. The other day, they picked 24 jams. By the way, maybe I'm a little innocent here, but I've never seen 24 jams open on a table. So there are these 24 jams, and people say, wow, 24 jams. And it turned out that 60% of the people actually stopped and said, well, I didn't know you have this watermelon, guava, orange mix. Pretty cool. What do you think the conversion rate was? Clearly, more choice here. And everything here in these six gems was in these 24. It's not just funny things.
Lower. 10%.
Lower of the 60.
Lower than
I'll give you a hint. The first digit is a 3. And the only digit is a 3. We did some work, Dan Ariely and I, at Match.com, a dating site in Texas. And we just looked at the empirical experiment they did by sending out emails once a week and saying, you have 3 dates. You probably have 50 dates. I mean. So, and then we plotted the opening rates versus that number. And it turns out that people, if you ask them, are much more excited with 50 dates. Unfortunately, just never get to actually opening that email because that takes, you know, really serious thought. Who of these people am I going to date? So sometimes it's just not clear whether complexity, which people demand, like, as I said, when I bought this 2 terabyte RAID disk last night, there are lots of 2 terabyte RAID disks. And finally, you want to actually have somebody who takes you by the hand and says, you know, buy this one or date this one. So complexity is, I think, an open question. One more story to this is that when people are given choice that gets too complex, they resort to the default, and that applies not just for graphic designers who get $50,000 a year, but also applies for well-paid doctors who supposedly get paid for making decisions. And the experiment there was done with people who said, you know, last night you went to bed and you had this patient coming in the morning for hip replacement, and you know, that's what you decided to do, hip replacement. You woke up in the morning, and then group A says, and you realize there's one drug you could give to the guy. Turns out, people think about it. The other group said, turns out there are 2 drugs you can give to the guy. So the people who are thinking about waking up in the morning, there's one drug, they go for the drug, because after all, hip replacement has its, you know, dangers and it's not cheap. The people who actually were thinking about 2 drugs, they said, it's too complex, let's stick with the hip replacement. So it's again that people, by adding choices, tend to sometimes not do themselves a favor, but the power of default is going to be which actually changes people's thinking there. Okay, that was what I wanted to say about the old data revolution. Now to the second data revolution, or the new data revolution. Are you ready? Yeah? Okay. So far, I've talked about data that primarily get produced by observing people's behavior, but very little of this is people voluntarily actually adding information, giving the company data out of whatever reasons. So the second consumer data revolution is that people are talking about themselves. Now, it is not, you know, like October versus November revolution, a clear cut. Amazon reviews are an early example of this second data revolution. But it really is negligible compared to what's happening now. Who of you is on Facebook? So about a third, actually, only of the people. It looks different in my Stanford course. I mean, Stanford would collapse without Facebook because I think that really is the lubricant. Maybe it's the right word, maybe not the right word.
Glue, okay,
I mean, some word like this. It really is the social fabric of how people interact and find out what's going on. So what do we mean by people finding out what's going on? People giving lots and lots of data, primarily about themselves, but also about their friends. Very different from just observing clicks, intentions, attention, location. So people, and I really think that those 2/3 of you who have not hung out at Facebook, you should spend a couple of hours just to understand, at least at the surface, what this enormous cultural shift is about. So the data revolution shifts of the second data revolution is that people are sharing lots and lots and lots of stuff about themselves. Why would they do this? What do you think? Why do people do that?
They're trying to find similar people, similar interests,
people trying to hook up, absolutely.
And it's also a courtesy of people that are legitimately interested.
It's a kind of self-marketing. People have a platform and they can present themselves there. People on average at Facebook spend 40 minutes a day, 40 freaking minutes a day in, you know, tweaking, you know, today I'm feeling this way. And so one of the exercises which we'll have in class is we will try to give people feedback of when do they get, you know, higher chances of, you know, hooking up if they say they feel this way versus if they feel that way. And it's not just about the truth. It's about people getting mental models, building mental models of depending on what data they produce about themselves, what data they explicitly generate. Not much is implicit there. It's explicitly generated data. What of this gets them closer to whatever their objective functions are? In terms of absolute amounts of data and in terms of number of participants, it is only, you know, maybe a tenth of the world's population. Something like that. Maybe MySpace, Facebook together. It's about a tenth of the world's population. But that tenth pretty much has most of the world's wealth associated with this. Our poor, you know, 700 million Chinese people who make more than a dollar a day, they're probably not on Facebook. But maybe they're on their mobile phones, actually. So if you think about data, don't just think internet. If you think about revealing data about yourself, think mobile as well. So the second data revolution is where people reveal stuff, whether it's true or not is a different question, about themselves, whether they say how they want to be perceived. And that is much more powerful than lots and most of the implicitly collected data. That was the question.
Standard question, but what's the age distribution of Facebook? Because my mental model is it's young people who with age going away from this.
Okay, so one unanswered question, because the Facebook culture isn't all that old yet, is will people, once they grow up, no longer do this, or maybe once they find a partner or something like this, no longer do that, or will they continue? We don't know. We just haven't been around. Facebook hasn't been around long enough to be able to answer this question.
Actually, I think it's the other way around. They are finding out that more and more, you know, the later generation spending time on Facebook.
Yes. So if you look at the age distribution, of course, self-reported age distribution, then you do find that while Facebook already is pretty much saturated a couple of years ago in the college area, the main growth rates are from people who are way beyond college in terms of age. So I have some students in class on Facebook who will probably find out the answers for you. It, in my opinion, is less than people, once they finish college, leave Facebook. It's more that we are trying to come up with meaningful applications and not just, you know, kissing and hugging and, you know, whatever the options are, people. Last quarter, 2 quarters ago in the fall quarter, there was a class at Stanford where about 60 students were in the class, formed groups of 3 each, and 6 out of those 10 groups, 6 out of those 20 groups managed to get 10 million downloads from the beginning of the quarter and the inception of the idea to the end of the 10-week quarter. So 10 million is a big number. And lots of lessons were learned of how to build virality into such applications. And one lesson, for instance, was that if there's a step you can remove, remove the step. And I sometimes, again, I don't know SAP, but if I, you know, use, for instance, banking software, I really wonder whether anybody ever applied that mindset, that if you only have one account, for instance, why do I have to pull down the menu and see this is the one account I can select? It's just so bad, so bad. And why is this the case? Because people have a very hard way of actually communicating that up. So sometimes I like to show just one slide, which I think summarizes quite well what's happening in this, you know, new consumer data revolution or in the second data revolution. And that is a slide where I say it used to be that on top of the pyramid is where decisions get made. So, for instance, in France, there might be the Académie Française, which determines on how a word is spoken, Germany Dudenredaktion. And this pyramid is going to be turned upside down, where it's no longer just the few, but it's the many which actually contribute the data, which create the knowledge. So in the last 10 minutes, before we turn over to the discussion here, I want to explore two consequences of this. One consequence is the consequence of the mindset on the consumer. And the other consequence is the consequence of the economics of data. So I believe after we have seen the first consumer data revolution, which primarily benefited companies, and we now have sort of the second data revolution where people at the beginning relatively naively and openly shared all kinds of things, did all kinds of stuff for companies, tagging images, uploading their product description, their pictures about their RAID devices, and so on and so forth. We are now reaching a stage where the mindset of the consumer is going to flip. And that's why I had as a subtitle of this talk, the new consumer data revolution, who pays whom, or pay or be paid. So what's happening is that consumers are demanding something in exchange to the data which they give. And they are no longer happy to say, oh yeah, we'll send you better advertisements. If you tell us, you know, how big your company is, and you know, so on, so don't worry about it, more stuff will arrive in your inbox and it will be more relevant for you. That's not what we're talking about right now. And we are, you know, in a world which is changing here, where consumers' expectations are changing. And I wanted to give you an example. I think tomorrow, on the 17th, Microsoft is launching with a new product, which is a product for the mobile device. And Eric Horowitz, at the same workshop where we were, actually talked a little bit about what's behind that. So this, for me, the 90s had the question, given a set of data, what insights can you provide? Similar to what your question was here before about what do we do with all this data? What insights can we get out of it? Not an easy business to be in. Then the last few years saw the question, given a certain problem, what data can you collect? Both Revolution 1, implicit data, and how can we create incentives so people actually can give us whatever they want to give us, including relationship data, which are much more sticky than the data about individuals. Now what's happening is that in this economization of the world, homo economicus, as we would say in German, people say, well, things are not that easy. Let's take, as an example, my GPS data. So am I, actually, who pays whom there? It used to be that I paid $10 a month to get traffic alerts on my GPS device. $10 a month. But hey, now I have one of these devices which actually gives my location. It's called mobile phone. Some of you have the same thing. Which gives the location actually up somewhere. So I'm actually giving them data. So I guess I should be paid. Right? Because that allows companies to actually figure out how is the flow. When I was a grad student, we did complicated traffic simulations on 101 on a connection machine at Xerox PARC. Lots of lights flashing and so on and so forth. Is it laminar flow or is it going to be turbulent flow? Who needs that anymore? If you can just measure how quickly are the mobile phones in front of you in 101 working? And maybe they know that you are 3% faster than the average. So you can have a pretty accurate estimate that you'll be late 3 minutes for dinner. And that, of course, can be transmitted right away because, you know, presumably the person who you're seeing for dinner is in your mobile phone and they know where you are and you can give permission and so on and so forth. So very, very different from before. So the question I had for you is, let's not just think about the world of data of either being on or being off. Let's think about it becoming an economic model. And I want to give you some examples. One, so I make the deal with my phone provider or whatever. And I said, okay, you can poll me 100 times a day. And for that, I want to get free service. Because you couldn't run your service if you didn't have my data. And please not within the 3-mile radius of this newfound best friend. Okay, let's leave that 3-mile radius out there. But the rest of the time, fair game. 100 times. If you need to poll me more, because you know you just wish you knew something about me, be my guest, but no longer for free. You have to pay me. And I think by introducing these microscopic amounts, maybe a penny per polling, not much, the world will become different. Another example is email. Yeah?
So these websites like
511.org? Yes. I believe 511.org actually gets some government data, so does Google, that the government collects data through either sensors, which are loops where they see inflow, outflow, or cameras which do recognition. You have a bunch of research projects, everything. I don't think in America they do it through mobile phones yet. Partly, you know, I made a phone call this morning, and the phone call dropped 4 times between San Francisco and here, including page mail. Fast Track is another example where you know how you... in Holland, for instance, you know, you could argue Holland is a smaller country. You get good phone coverage there. By the way, China, too, big country, good phone coverage, 3G since April 1st. In Holland, Vodafone has a project that assumes that the data is free. Not quite the correct assumption, but with needles, if you go from Eindhoven to, you know, Rotterdam, you will leave now and you arrive, you know, exactly this time, plus minus 3 minutes. Unless, of course, there's an accident run through. I mean, there's always a small long tail effect which you can't predict. Dash is a company here which tries to do this of having two-way communication, Wi-Fi, you know, whatever you have available there. So was there another question?
What do you think about the mindset of the customer shift in terms of privacy? Are people trading privacy against
So that is just what this example was for, that I'm willing to give up my privacy if I see a benefit for myself. So this pathetic, how many employees does your organization have? What kind of purchasing decision do you make? Would you mind selecting from the following 73 attributes which describes your position best? Forget it. Nobody will be doing this anymore because people know they just do it for this company to make money from some marketing, which we talked about. It's better targeted to you. You now get the CIO news. I think that is clearly on its way out. Think about how we move from CRM to VRM, that if SAP had a module where me as the end user, the guy who is, you know, say, interested in Canon cameras, that I can actually make explicit that I'm in the market for a new camera. I've had my 5D for a number of years now. Well, if something really cool, which has, you know, better da-da-da night, low light conditions, comes out, send me something. So suddenly, you become a very different world where you think about what are you interested in. Recommendations, which are right now based on the past, and how many cameras do you buy? 1-2 a year, probably not more than that. Suddenly becomes something which is focused on the future. Show me stuff. You're interested in cars, you know, if the, you know, BMW 1 Series makes it in America, maybe I'm interested in that. Focus from the past turns over to a focus on the future. Focus on passively somebody pushing something down your throat because they think it's good for you to, you actively pulling something. Or most importantly, the focus from search to moving a focus on discovery. Search, you already know what you're looking for, otherwise you wouldn't end at Domino's Pizza. Discovery is, show me stuff I don't know about yet. That is an interesting thing. How can we get this? Now, looping back to the data sources, to the first and to the second part, the first part allows us to have implicit data from people with a persistent history who are slightly ahead of us. So let's say if a person gets up early in the morning and is in the office already at 10 o'clock or something like this, then, you know, they are ahead of me in discovering what Arik is interested in. When I come in, I might as well profit from their 3 hours of work before I rolled in. So that is the source of what I call social discovery. If somebody recommends something to you, it's very much more powerful than only this anonymous thing. People bought X, also bought Y. I don't care about people. Who cares about people? I care about, you know, John. If John bought X and John is my friend, it's much more powerful for me. Maybe I should also buy X than if people bought X, also bought Y. The second source of getting data here to build state is what I always like to use my mobile phone for. So I have a mobile phone, and it's actually quite smart. It, for instance, knows who my friends are because it has a contact list. That's different from Facebook. In Facebook, in this sort of generation minus three software, I need to acknowledge friends. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have had lots of mobile phone conversations preparing this talk here. Facebook still asks me, do you want to be friends? Do you know Dennis? Of course I know Dennis, but why can't I just look up on my calling list that I know Dennis? By the way, another thing is highly problematic. There's either you're somebody's friend or you're not somebody's friend. It's not how the world works. No, that's not. And another thing which is highly problematic is this bilateral relationship. So if you think other software, like Twitter allows you from your mobile phone to send a message, 140 characters, and add messages out in the world, whoever wants to listen to you. So that's another totally different communication model. Not this, you know, we confirm that we are friends. But, hey, I'm Twittering out in the world, and whoever wants to listen to me, not many people do, but whoever wants to listen to me, they can listen to me, and so I have an audience there. So it's not the bilateral relationships which matter, but there are lots of people out there who might be interested in what I have to say. And then if I have, for instance, you know, a new idea or a job to offer, then we just need to provide them with ideas of how they can respond to that. Very different paradigms from the social networks minus three or whatever version which we have right now where we confirm friends. But back to the mobile phone, actually. So my mobile phone knows who my friends are. I don't have to tell it. It knows, for instance, who I pushed to voicemail. Ah, what? This person again, nuked. It knows my calendar, knows whether I'm late, whether I'm on time, it knows where I ought to be versus where I am, it knows whatever. What else does it know? It has a camera, actually. My mobile phone has a camera. So it sees. It has a microphone. I think all mobile phones are here have microphones because that means it can figure out what the situation is. Like, I'm talking nonstop here. That must be a funny situation in which it probably better should not ring versus if I'm in the car, listening to music. It has also a location sensor. So it knows it's moving, so if I'm listening to music, sure, it could interrupt me. So all of that stuff is there. All of this rich data we have, all this rich situation we could compute. And what does it do? It either rings or it doesn't ring, depending on my setting. How pathetic is that? First thing I would like to say is what the consumer expectations are going to is make something which actually understands me a little bit better. Second thing I would say is make something where I, if I'm the caller, can communicate metadata, whether actually I need to tell Dennis that I am late because the traffic is harder because I don't have this dash device yet. The traffic was worse from San Francisco coming down here than I thought. Then I want to get through to him, or at least a short message or something like this, as opposed to the poor guy leaving for the restaurant and then waiting for half an hour for me. So how not only can we estimate the state of the user, but how can we, in addition to that, give the sender the possibility to increase some metadata. So in my case, some blog entries in my blog are better than others. So why should I only have implicit data where people, based on other people's reading behavior, figure this blog entry wasn't all that great, but this one we should read? Why not just give me the option of saying, here are my top three entries, here are my top five entries, here are my top 10 entries? Or another example here, I mentioned that my phone call dropped four times today as I was driving from San Francisco. I got an ad in the mail from Verizon, my previous phone company, who had 8 years ago when they lived in New Jersey. And that ad said, we are now proud that we have four out of individuals pictured. They are Mary, Joe, you know, whatever they're called, and they are constantly working for you. You have heard that slogan, working for you, never stopping working for you. They are driving through New Jersey. By the way, I lived in New York, so it's really interesting that they sent me something about New Jersey. It's good too, but you know, not relevant in California. And I was wondering, why not maybe either look at the data and see where the calls drop? I think that would be sort of an idea. You know, I don't want to push it too hard, but I think that should be an exercise which, you know, should be able to do in a day. Just see where to get calls. And then do a mashup with Google Maps and see where maybe you want to put the next tower there where the calls get dropped. PageMe Road seems to be quite bad on T-Mobile. And the other one was, why not just allow people to put flags up on a Google Map or Yahoo Map where they want to have actually better service? And that is the new consumer revolution, that people are willing to do such things if down the road they see that they benefit from that. And I see companies clearly bifurcating, that there are those companies which don't get it. Maybe United Airlines could be an example there. That companies which try to live and milk the last drop out of the asymmetry of information they have with the customer. That United knows freaking well who I am. You know, I'm 1K, so they know my flying history. And they're not willing to reveal the identity of the agent who told me that that ticket, yes, is upgradable. I arrived at the airport and said, who told you it's upgradable? You didn't pay enough. Well, you know, I spent, you know, whatever, $1,300 on the ticket because I was told it's upgradable, as opposed to the $400 I could have spent. Then, no, sir, it's not upgradable. But we have a nice middle seat in economy for you. to Heathrow. So there are companies which don't get it, which try to live in a transaction-based economy. Hey, we made the $1,300, but we lost the customer. But transaction-based versus relationship-based. Relationship-based is that people don't just optimize for the short term. Yes, they sold that ticket of $1,300 as opposed to $300 or $500. But relationship-based is that they say, we understand that in the first data revolution, we wanted transparency into our customers. We wanted to be able to treat our customers as objects. We wanted to target them, all these military patterns. We wanted to segment them. You know, I'm thinking about somebody who deals with dead bodies and sort of cuts them up. Is that the word? What do you, in anatomy, do you segment people?
Dissect.
Dissect. We dissect our customer base. Yeah, you know the metaphors? We have customer relationship management with fly paper. Fly comes, puts leg there, yes, we have that fly, stickiness and so on. That was the first data revolution. Transparency internally, good thing. SAP certainly helps for that. But the only thing was that there was one guy who was left out of the equation, named the customer. The second customer and the ensuing customer mindset revolution is that people say no longer that. Customers have a voice. There's a wonderful group in San Francisco called the Conversation Group. Peter Hirschberg was the chief marketing officer at Apple before, who is one of the partners and co-founders there, who have good tools understanding what those customer voices are saying. So if you are not sure what airline to take, going back to that example, in the second revolution, it is that some airlines happily provide you with information about who gave you that information. And now this transparency, which used to be an internal transparency, becomes an external transparency, that I want to know who is that person who told me that I can get upgraded for paying my $1,300. And I think the question for a company like SAP is, what can we create so customers who are calling in, talking to people who use SAP systems, are able to, one, contribute. I worked with Lufthansa in their call center in China. And turns out that this call center, I hope it's no secret here, they try to have 20% overcapacity at every given point in time. So it's not like in America, that the wait times really are short. So that means 20% of people sit there and twiddle their thumbs. So you might as well have them do stuff. And what they do is they write in blogs as Lufthansa employees, as call center employees, no funny business there. And they use their time in actually contributing stuff which, you know, hopefully helps for these conversations, answer questions people have on their blogs. Why did this machine get canceled? And so on and so forth. So to summarize, I think we are very good in having understood the first data revolution in the first 10 years of the web. And what was interesting is to see that what took us 10 years had on the first day already implications which went beyond what traditional retail, point of sales data, etc., were about. In the last couple of years, we have seen two things. One, the shift from given a set of data, what are the insights, to given the problem, what data can we get? And not uncorrelated with that, the shift that people voluntarily give, reveal lots of data about how they want to be perceived. The more the future they will see in a given system depends on what they're giving, the more truthful and the more consistent the data will be that people provide. Because if you give random data and you get random recommendations afterwards, it's not a fun game in the long term. What we are just barely seeing now is the consumer part of the second revolution, where people say, and what we are giving to you is no longer free. So we are no longer the sheep who, upon asked about age and whatever it is, say 1911. By the way, 1% of the world's population was born 1111. We found that out at Amazon when we looked at the data. Very interesting. No demographer knew about this. Rather than giving irrelevant data or wrong data, people say, we are going to deal with explicit or implicitly, beginning implicitly, an economic model of our data. We want to get something for that. So if I'm going to tell you, dear company XYZ, that I would like to, you know, potentially buy a house, and I allow you to sell me, like Nextag does that, to sell me to mortgage agents, then I want to see something coming back from you. Otherwise, I'm not going to Nextag, but I'm going to your competitor and tell them that I'm going interested in buying a house and getting a mortgage. So I live in a world of data, and I think most of you live in a world of data as well. We, I think, are only at the very beginning when it comes to what people read of themselves and really only trying the first touching of the toe into the cold water, trying to understand what the economic implications are. I'm going to close with a couple of examples which I prepared to show you that companies are already being produced which live in this world and which create stuff. Here's Get Satisfaction, San Francisco-based company. Get Satisfaction says, well, dear, let's stick to the example of United Airlines. The United Airlines, it turns out that United apparently answers only 4% of all the letters written to them. It could be 0%. So. And it says, well, people are having those conversations anyways, whether you want to listen to them or not. And what Get Satisfaction provides, it's a platform where those conversations between individuals are happening, not, you know, nice brochures about, you know, in 2017 they will actually have an upgraded business class, but conversations people have about frequent flyer programs. Let me ask you, who of you had this year alone, in the first, you know, 3.5 months, a conversation about any frequent flyer program? Okay, it's about half of the room. So just, you know, random topic, we talk about these things, you know. And now what companies can do is they can listen into these conversations. That's a good start. And then see what actually is happening there. So Get Satisfaction provides a platform where companies can then enter truthfully and saying, we actually work for United, and here are the reasons why we are not giving away. These are conversations happening not on United's website, but on getsatisfaction.com. It's a forum. It's a forum. Totally smooth login, no hard work there. And the effect is that people are having these conversations. And then, you know, the honest question for United is, do you want to participate, or do you want to pretend that everything is good and nobody's actually listening to you? Next example.
Together and how to get the best data from groups acting into one idea as opposed to
One belief I have is that the future of work is dominated by platforms systems we are creating where individuals can contribute. So the reason my examples are from the individual contributor area is this pyramid I drew you, is that if you have, as in the case of the GPS, 100,000 more people contributing data, that just raw power of the data is more powerful than what individual paid contributors can do. Traditionally, companies used to pay people to create data. An example could be like Encyclopedia Britannica. People got paid. Nobody gets paid to contribute to Wikipedia. But you have... What's that? It's actually, some people argue that the quality of Wikipedia is better than the quality of Encyclopedia Britannica. So the fact is that if you have lots of people, and there's actually not that many people contributing to Wikipedia, you can just, I mean, my example, personal example is Mood Logic, that you will find somebody who is interested in a certain song who actually puts his heart in, or, you know, 2 minutes of his time in, and actually fills out the dimension of that song. And not for economic reasons. But, you know, for one thing, they just love that song. And they feel like other people should love that song as well. Here's an example of a company called Jigsaw. I don't know whether SAP has anything to do with sales. Is there a module for sales or something like this?
Oh.
Okay. All right. I knew there had to be something like that. So we all know those guys in suits. They all left early. Nobody left in suit here. So these guys, they're outside, the guys in the suits and the ties. And they usually come with briefcases, and they say, you know, when they, you know, I have a large Rolodex. So mine is bigger than yours. They mean the Rolodex. And, well, those guys live in the world of the past because they, just like in the United example, this information asymmetry, they believe that the funny thing, which they call Rolodex, is something which distinguishes them from other people. A company called Jigsaw, I have no business relationship with the company, says, all right, at the end of last year, they already had 7 million business cards collected. So, for instance, if you want to get to know Jeff Bezos' phone number, his mobile number, short of asking me right now, how would you actually go about that? Maybe it might show up if you do a Google search, non-trivial. Well, you go to Jigsaw. Somebody uploaded, and please don't tell him who did. Somebody uploaded the address book. And so anytime now somebody actually wants to access Jeff's mobile number, you know, it rings in my pocket. Good deal. So here is 200,000 people did that. And that's a pretty good collection of corporate America of the numbers which are hard to get otherwise.
Great model, but if somebody just added, if LinkedIn added the feature for phone numbers, would that still make sense? But that's a side question.
Here's the good question, the difference. LinkedIn is self-reported information. This one is the pyramid upside down. It's other people report information. Plus, on top of that, there's a feature community corrects. So if somebody calls a number and it says Domino's Pizza, then they say, damn, I shouldn't have paid those.
Is this running afoul again of privacy issues? Someone does not obviously want their data put in, but there's no way to trace where it came from.
And, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I mean, my attitude to privacy is that I put my mobile phone number right on my front page because you know, might as well make it easy for people, and so this way, if they go to Viagra.com, they actually know to reach me. They don't have to work hard on this. So what you need to do is you need to build... my phone has an off switch, for instance, which helps me to then not get interrupted. And here it says, I'm currently in San Francisco. Please call me at, here's my number, email, and you can check out my itinerary. So my view is here that you might as well make it easy to people. So if I click on my itinerary here... then, you know, it shows you that I'm having, for instance, on Friday next week, post Web 2.0 party at 7 o'clock at my place. And if you want to know anything I do in San Francisco, I just tick on SFO, and it only shows me the things which happen in San Francisco. So I think that's one approach to privacy. Because, I mean, what negative things can happen here? That somebody can find out where I live? Well, there's a phone book. And so people just don't think this through deeply. But I want to talk about business models. So one thing is those people who have big Rolodexes, that they get disintermediated by companies like Jigsaw. Here's the next example. A company called JobScore, which I just saw on the web yesterday, again, no relationship with them, will be one of the companies on Launchpad next week at the Web 2 Expo in San Francisco. What they do is they say a significant amount of energy goes into hiring people or goes into attempting to hire people and then not hiring them down the road. Companies like Google, Amazon, SAP, probably for every one person you hire, probably interview 10 people or even a larger family than that. So wouldn't it be good for the economy if your rejects, where you spent your brain power interviewing them and took those notes down, if your rejects were that annotations you have made available for the rest of the world? Didn't work out at SAP, but maybe they have a job at Microsoft for them, or Domino's Pizza, who knows? That's the idea here, that you allow people to just track applicants. So the software is, I'm sure, another SAP module is doing HR, and you have the funnel and you can enter the information about the candidate and find out how often has he already applied or did she get married in between. This one is more interesting here. It says, hey, if you give data, you get data. And you're looking for good applicants. Different companies have different wishes. We help you find people who fit your profile better than what might have been otherwise the case. And the last two examples in the first data revolution are, again, real examples. These are not things I made up. This is from Adobe Flash, installed on 820 million, almost a billion internet computers. As I was preparing a talk for the Web2.0 Expo last year, I indeed got this screen. Allow Amazon Web Services to access your camera and microphone. Wow. Of course, yes, because that way, they understand the situation I'm in and they can serve me better ads and so on. Great, great. I was quite impressed that, my little Lenovo thing here, that it asked me whether I would allow Amazon to, figure out, am I sitting there by myself? I'm not even sitting there. I'm sitting there with somebody. I'm concentrated. What is the face and expression and so on and so forth. Very powerful for actually sending people the right ads. And finally, here's a company which I think is in this area here called IMMI. So you have a mobile phone, and every half minute, the mobile phone collects 10 seconds of sound, does a little bit of processing, and sends it up to some central server every half minute. And then that central server figures out what you're doing. So in my case, 8:03 in the morning, Andreas in the shower. 8:04 in the morning, Andreas in the shower. 8:07 in the morning, Andreas in the shower. 8:14 in the Andreas in the shower. Clearly a candidate for separate shampoo and conditioner. So what do we expect in this new customer data revolution? What do you expect in response to that? So I think these are just a few examples. I can go on and on and on forever here, hundreds of slides of these companies, where they are trying to figure out by one, old data revolution, this one, two, new data revolution, the example of the business cards, getting people together. What can we create for the what value can we create for the end user? And then the deep question is, how do the expectations of the end user shift? And I have no answers for that, but it's clear to me that the battle of the 90s of creating internal transparency and the battle of the mid-2000s of customers demanding from the outside transparency, accountability of firms, what they told you, they said it would happen, why did it not happen? is now going to move into an expectation of the economics of data, where people expect to get paid if they feel that they give more than what they are getting back. We have a couple of minutes left for questions. Yes. I think the other way around. If you ask somebody to type up some phone numbers from a sheet, like if I ask my TA at Stanford to type up those numbers, he is much less incentivated to really carefully check them than if these were people who is personally interested and want to make sure he can reach them down the road. So I think the key is that this notion of paying people to create data is a notion which is anchored about 100 years ago when the transaction costs between firms were high. But, and that's how we met, in the context of collective intelligence, which is defined that the transaction costs, the communication costs, the collaboration costs are very, very, very small. Very different things, very different dynamics are happening. Three kinds. One is you can decompose a problem. Amazon.com's mturk.com, where you can post questions, like you can have somebody check phone numbers for restaurants, pay them 1 cent, 1 penny for answering the question. So you can actually afford maybe having three people make the phone call. And if they all agree, then you're pretty sure that that restaurant actually exists. That is what I call decompositional collective intelligence. The second form is where you want to have diverse populations doing analysis, coming up with maybe different answers to the same questions in order to, like in Wall Street, reduce the risk given a certain expected return. Like you average, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You try to have actually different stocks in your portfolio, and that way you get your 1/√n in the aerodrome. And the third one is the one I'm most interested in. That's when emergent properties happen. That's collective intelligence through interaction. So the first one has no interaction. I just farm it out. People in Urumqi are just as happy to answer the questions people in Palo Alto. Second one is I try to have a heterogeneous population so the errors sort of average out. Less error with the same signal. Third one is the interesting one. How can we actually get people to now truly collaborate? And I think in my very simplistic understanding of what enterprise-grade software should be doing, that I could see should be one of the goals, that we get people, we empower people, and not only the knowledge workers, the bees who are sitting there being paid to collect data or to transcribe something, but the people who genuinely have interest and genuinely are interested in fixing something, sharing the information with the company. That, for me, is a challenge which I would love to explore with you further and learn from you more of where you think this could be going and bounce it off to my view, which is a very customer-centric view and not the enterprise-centric view. You saw that coming through, that I always think about how we can get end users, the end-end users, not the ones who use SAP, but the ones who they talk to actually contribute with stuff. And there are lots of possibilities. The call center example of having this 20% spare capacity contributing beyond, yes, how can we help you, is just one step in the right direction, I think. Yes.
Now, if we just theoretically expand it, and now I tell them, okay, your example
yeah.
Putting more times and now you pay me for this, the thing that's coming out of them, so what's their incentive? Of course, Veritas Motion is for 1 trillion.
I think Chris Anderson in the last Wired magazine has a wonderful article entitled Free. And the point he makes is that Gillette is the typical model where you get for free the, you know, the frame and then you buy the blades. It was a model which was 100 years ago shifting within one consumer the money stream from one thing to another, from the entire device just to the blade. What we have seen in this digital network economy is that we shift the money not within one computer who now pays for the blades as opposed to for the whole thing, creating stickiness, fly paper, and so on and so forth. But we shifted from having another party pay for us. So a shift for the first example would be that instead of paying for the airline seat, of course, is free. But in order to maybe check in luggage, that would be $10. And you know, in order to get a window seat, that would be another $5. And in order maybe to not see ads, you have to pay another $20, and so on and so forth. So that's the first model. The second model is what the Google AdWords model is. That, you know, we pay nothing for a Google search, email, Gmail, and so on and so forth. Others do. And actually, we all work for Google by clicking. Because every time I click, Google makes money. So I think inventing relationships, when you service providers here, could be the carriers, where another party is interested in my information, selling my information. As I said, you know, if I'm interested in another mortgage, hey, you pay me if I buy it from you. I give you information about, I'm interested in another camera, you pay me for that. Much more efficient than cameras, that companies just buying spots on television. And I see that, what I said before, moving from CRM to vendor relationship management, that I manage my vendors, that I have trusted relationships potentially with an intermediary who has my information. That could be a credit card company. OpenID might be going in the direction. I don't know yet who will occupy that space. And so specifically the example about mobile phones, I think phone calls will be free. Basically, phone calls are free. I think, you know, the services which the phone companies provide us with better be free. But the question is, what products can we invent? And I think the product of having something which makes the phone ring when I'm actually interested in having the phone ring, that would be worth a couple of days a month, a couple of dollars a day. I would be happy to pay a few bucks a day if my phone learned the preference that if you call me, sure, you can call me anytime. If you call me, you know, maybe if I have nothing better to do, I'm driving. So services like this, so it's not that people don't want to pay. It's people don't want to pay for stupid stuff. And so I think most of you would be willing, if your phone only rang when you genuinely want to get the call, how much are you willing to pay for that a day? As much as you're paying for your cafe latte at Starbucks, $8 or whatever these days? Probably yes. We had another couple of hands up here. And should we just go in chronological order? No.
I just was wondering, in that relationship where there isn't money exchanged or value for money, where it's really somebody expecting a return for their information down the road, how far is down the road? What is the relationship of time there when somebody says, oh, I put this information in and nothing came of it?
People say 30 seconds. So Netflix is an example where it's done very well. That if you change the rating on a movie, flashy, new movies appear. So I don't know the number. I just heard that number. My view is that we should not underestimate mental models that people are building. I personally, my PhD advisor was Dave Rummelhardt, who did a lot of work in mental models and psychology. So I personally really believe that mental models and getting people the right feedback so they can build the right model about the world is something which is very, very important. Ultimately, we are not that different from Skinner's pigeons who were starved and then randomly fed stuff. And they performed dances to those patterns which they saw in their feeding, which weren't actually there. So I think we're all there the same way that we see patterns, whether they are there or not. And if we can help people to direct their behavior towards something which down the road is actually better for them, I think we have a big, we will see that. Given that people spend their 40 minutes on Facebook each day figuring out, you know, what state that they have in order to get the maximum, you know, response rate, whatever they are trying to get response rate off, it is, I think, these short times that I try something and I see who is responding. Certainly, impact on loyalty programs is huge. Does anybody know anything about loyalty programs? Probably not something in crop, a little bit. Yeah, so I think loyalty programs which try to appeal for, you know, your life after death don't have all that much, they're called religion. They don't have all that much appeal anymore. I think it's much more the shorter-term rewards people are looking for. And if you think deeply, what has changed? There are two things which have changed. Communication being free has changed. The bidirectional communication being free. I mean, television always was free, the one-way communication. Or driving by, you know, 101 and seeing sort of bulletin boards there has always been free. But that's not the communication I'm talking about. I'm talking about the bidirectional communication, my mobile phone transmitting how I'm driving and stuff like this. So that has changed. And the fact that I can reach anybody in the world for bidirectional communication, like the students in Urumqi who are helping with Mechanical Turk. And the other thing which has changed is that the time scales just have dropped. So, I mean, at heart, I'm, you know, a physicist and engineer. So I think about the world in very simple terms. And one is really, what is the round-trip time scale of a package? And I know some of you get nervous during the talk and reach in your pockets, and you just need to check whether there's a new email there, because it's just socially unacceptable to not respond to an email in less than, you know, whatever it is, an hour or whatever the time scale is. I mean, I know friends in China, at Tsinghua, who actually pride themselves in their job application cover letters, that they are reachable 24/7. So you want to call them at 7 o'clock in the morning or at 4 o'clock in the morning, they're there, they're answering their phone. As opposed to other countries like, you know, Germany, for instance, where people pride themselves that they are turning off their mobile phone at 5 o'clock in the evening. So these are just different cultures. Yes?
Do you think that with this second data revolution, one problem is going to be the overwhelmed people who are being asked to provide those information?
Okay. Yes. So
if they are not already overwhelmed.
People are overwhelmed. And I had a guy, Goldhaber was his name, come to class at Stanford maybe 2 years ago. And he wrote a few good chapters on the attention economy. That's why I didn't come to class. But what I was much more impressed by was he produced that manuscript, typewriter written. Typewriters were things where they had mechanical. You push a key and something happens. From, I think, like the 70s or something like this, maybe, it's definitely an age before we had word processors, maybe 81, 79, 81, on information overload. And I read this and it just sounded as if, you know, I read it on a blog today. So I think this problem of information overload seems to be relatively time invariant. I think people always had more information they could deal with. And what is new is, I think, how we deal with complexity, and we haven't understood that yet. That's why I give you the Dräger's example. That's why I give you the dating site as an example. How many choices do you have? Do you want to look at 1,000 people before you make a decision, or are you happy if you meet the 3 people in your hometown? So to your question, as a byproduct, or as a consequence, rather, of having so much information, the focus shifts on what I call relevance functions. So whether it's search, in 93 I was excited. Actually, for a number of years, if you typed Andreas in Google, I was the top hit. Pretty cool. No longer the case. What we have shifted from, wow, somebody finds my page, isn't that cool, to, well, which out of the hundreds of thousands of pages about me should be displayed on the first page? That problem appears again and again everywhere. Product recommendations. Yes, millions, tens of millions of products I can buy at Amazon.com. Which should be those few which my attention might be worth it in this moment? It's a problem of ranking, relevance ranking. People, discovering people, same thing. If I go to Facebook and says, hey, here's some people you might want to get to know, Facebook knows a hell of a lot about what kind of people I'm clicking at. Or if you think about feature discoverability, I hear SAP has many features built in. Many people working very hard to build in even more features in SAP. Keystroke, you said, you know, people are good in memorizing keystroke sequences. It's like at the airlines when you need to make a seat reservation or something like this. They just know how to do it. And so which feature should we actually help surface to people? What are relevant new features? So you have a very roundabout way of getting something done. Maybe we should just show you that if you scratch yourself behind the left egg and, you know, wiggle your right toe, then that feature will be happening automatically. So all of these things are out of the plethora of possible things, finding those which might be relevant to you in a given situation. So in that sense, I think that's the unifying framework. If there are tasks which I think you would be happy to contribute to, like rate your friends, who are the most dateable of your friends, and all these apps, then you have to find stuff which is of interest to you to do then. So nothing really new about this, but the scale of things, and most importantly, the data which actually drive those behaviors. That really is new. That some of these data sources, for instance, you providing relationship data to the people you know, that is qualitatively new. Qualitative, not just quantitatively. We have four more hands up. Can we still briefly take those people?
Sure.
Yeah. Your hand was up for a long time.
Just a quick follow-up on what you were talking about before. So Facebook ran this experiment with Beacon, right? And
yeah.
Kind of backfired. And that sounds a little paradoxical to what you're talking about, that you're willing to give up some of the data, some of the privacy in return for something much more valuable. But
absolutely. The idea was that we show to people what their friends bought, and not everyone was happy about this. And it is an evolutionary process. People overshoot and they backtrack, but they're still collecting the data. Sorry about that. I've been ignoring you for the last half hour.
No, it's all right. Now, so there were some earlier questions about the impact in the enterprise and how it's different in terms of how we're thinking about it. We have this concept of an ecosystem of partners that want to reach our customers and all of this kind of thing. One of the things that seems to me, all this intuitively does make sense from a consumer point of view. One of the things that seems to be more difficult to figure out from an enterprise perspective is when an individual says, I like this product, I recommend this product, that same individual, when they're with Coca-Cola, who's a customer of ours, is more valuable to me than that same individual who doesn't tell me they're with Coca-Cola, so I have no idea what they represent. So if we then do the pyramid upside down and say, you know, as a consumer, as a provider of information, I want to be paid. Well, if I pay the Coca-Cola person more, incent them in some way, now they're getting an individual benefit at Coca-Cola's expense, right? For giving up Coca-Cola's price, which I just did. It's that in a concept. How do we deal with, or any thoughts on how we deal with that individual versus enterprise problem?
No deep insights, just two shallow insights. One is, I think I read the number that 60 or 70% of the sort of GDP in the United States ultimately is stuff which gets sold to people like you and me. So it is 60-something percent, I think. Certainly more than half. Now, if you think about it, actually, many of the things which ultimately, you know, maybe Shell buys, you know, raw oil and refines and stuff like this. All these things ultimately are there to power the end user. You know, the fact that AT&T puts up mobile base stations, superconducting base stations, so I might even have the ability to actually receive a phone call at home. These are ultimately all the things which benefit the end user. So all these ads about which companies run SAP, I see at various airports. Ultimately, you know, if there was nobody buying it on the road, Porsche or whatever it is, it would be pretty difficult to make money. There are, you know, military stuff, which I don't know anything about, actually. Some of the customers you mentioned are military customers at Generation Gap and so on and so forth. So I cannot talk about those. But about the stuff which ultimately is bought by regular people like us, I think that is certainly about two-thirds of the economy. So for those, I think people are willing to contribute data, and that's a significant part. That was the one shallow insight. I think one shallow insight is enough. There was one more question here. Yes?
Yeah, with all the user-centricness,
yes.
How do you deal with scam?
Scam.
You talked a lot about the data, and actually you didn't distinguish it, and which I found pretty interesting, that you just don't distinguish between, or you purposely only mentioned data and information. So, I mean, there's some sort of process that turns data into information. So you actually picking the one cottage cheese and not the other one, you have the data that you picked it or laid down the first one, and you deduct some information about the user. But actually, because this process is pretty error-prone, I think, and it opens up to a possibility of scam. So I, for example, I could make up a completely false identity on Facebook or whatever, or I can completely make up a fake company using Jigsaw because I scan in some business cards, nobody knows where they came from, and everybody who kind of like, what is this company? Maybe I can find a CIO on Jigsaw. Yeah, there he is. And certainly I trust this.
Okay. More. So you said two things. One is that you can fake things about, you know, your own data, like the low-fat cream cheese, full-fat cream cheese. And the other one is that you can, you know, upload fake data. Maybe Jeff Bezos' wrong number, you know, as I said, Domino's Pizza, onto Jigsaw. So I think the answer is, why would you do it? What is the economic incentive to create a company, to scan in business cards, and to have people sort of make phone calls which end up at your mother-in-law or something like that? And I think if you really think through things with this very small transaction costs we have, then it, for instance, we talked about lunch today about identity theft. And I learned that identity theft, it's about $25,000 it takes to fix it. But it also means for $25,000 I can sort of, you know, fix somebody else's fixing inverted commas record. So if I make more than $25,000 on average, then all the power, we should just be getting out of the room right now and, you know, get to business here and, you know, figure out how we can use our intelligence to do identity theft. So ultimately, I think because the internet, the scale, is just so fast, the time scales have dropped to zero. It is really the economics of very low margins which ultimately allow us to send out lots of emails. And hey, if somebody buys Viagra on the phone, or, you know, I get this email the other day about some guy in Africa. He inherited, I think, $10.5 million. And I thought it would be great. He asked me to help him. So so I think somebody, I didn't get to make the phone call, but somebody is going to help him out there. And as long as he makes more money with that guy who's helping out there than he pays by having, you know, 100 people asking call centers, yeah, he has a fine business.
But, you know, that can destroy, like, a good business idea. Like, for example, the Google page count. I mean, started by how many people link to
page. Absolutely.
And then you set up link farms, for example.
Absolutely. It's... It is always, I think, an arms race that there will be you, whatever thing you come up with in this key task of having relevance ranking. Whatever you can come up with, PageRank as an example, click-through rates, click fraud, there always will be some people abuse it. And ultimately, you just fix it and you move on. Click fraud, the last example you gave, is a good example that, hey, if there's a spike in clicks, just simply ignore it. Don't charge the customer for it. You have a model which tells you unlikely that on that afternoon suddenly, you know, 10 times more people came than on any afternoon before. So just, you know, don't even tell the customer about it.
Coming back to a mathematical model then, kind of what are the probabilities and all that stuff, and you actually, you did it in the first place to get rid of it.
So the last decade was a decade of algorithms. We worked very hard on machine learning algorithms. This decade is the decade of data collection, and next decade is the one of economics of data. So I think algorithms are a good thing to have. Creating transparency and allowing you, for instance, to understand what other business cards did that person who made up that fake company on Jigsaw and uploaded those business cards of that fake company, what other stuff has he done? What other, with persistent history yet pseudonymity, what other information has he uploaded? And how did people vote on that information? It's very easy to come up with a ranking algorithm which puts those people pretty much at the bottom. So you can leave them in, no problem, no harm done. Nobody will ever see them because nobody scores to address number 7 million in that books. So the deep element here is that you allow people to contribute whatever they want to contribute, but your relevance function is informed by how other people judge about the contributions, which could be either done explicitly by them giving feedback and saying, yes, this actually was Jeff Bezos' phone number, or it could be done implicitly, long clicks versus short clicks being implicit negative feedback.
One more question?
You're the boss.
You're getting close to, I know you need to
go. One more question, so, and then we wrap up.
Related to the scamming, related to being paid for information and perhaps paying for being anonymous. So I'm fascinated by the loyalty card at the grocery. So essentially, if you have this card, they're tracking your purchases, and that's the vehicle that they do it with, and you get a discount.
No, no, it's the other way around. You pay a premium if you don't have a loyalty card.
Exactly. That's where I was getting to. And so you pay, and the only reason to pay for that is to pay for anonymity.
Yeah.
So why would one want to pay for anonymity? And I think, well, maybe I don't want my insurance company, which is maybe in the safe way, to track.
Yes, these are the ones who check whether you buy
cigarettes, vodka, and Hustler Mag, which support and high test gas, which is all part of the orderly death. And so, is that a model of you buy anonymity, and then you all of a sudden, by buying anonymity, lose? All of a sudden, they're charged more for other things. It's like, okay, you can be anonymous, but your insurance rates are going to go up because, you know what? We can't see what you're eating.
Yes. So let me give
and
three.
And then I would end up paying, which is that a good thing for all of us? Because we all pay into a pool and we want to know who's smoking cigarettes and vodka so that they pay a higher insurance rate so that my rate goes up.
Let me wrap this up by contrasting two things. On Monday, my class, I came with a FedEx box, which had arrived, and told the students, using that FedEx box, that that costs about as much as 2 terabytes of storage. So I set up certain expectations. I said, remind me at 6 o'clock, I will open up this box for you. So time comes, 1 to 6, professor, we need, okay, great, wrapping up class. Camera, please, on the FedEx box. Okay, I open up the FedEx box. They expected something like 2 terabytes of storage, and you know, how exciting can that be? But no, there was a data collection device in there. Data collection device worth $1,000. Okay. And then this year is the result. Any idea? Just has a FedEx label on it. Anybody knows what this is about? What's that? That's my data. So I actually need to find a FedEx Dropbox here. So that was the data collection for edit for $1,000. Namely, I spit into this here, and I'm sending it to 23andMe. And they do a DNA analysis, which is one way of, you know, finding out about, you know, stuff insurance companies might be very interested in knowing, maybe my risks, much more than, you know, stuff, you know, the examples you gave. That's all in here. Going to FedEx today. So the problem there is that I can't do all that much about my DNA. So you want, from a social perspective, what you're talking about here, you want to think about where can you change behavior. Going back at the very beginning of the talk, when somebody over there asked about, you know, we have all these data, how do we get insights out of the data, and said, well, you start with the actions, left side, right side, the blue thing, kind of that. So the same thing is, think, is true in this example here, which is promised the last example today, Norwich Union, a car insurance company, which says, look, it makes no sense that, Andreas, when you hang out in China and your car is in the garage in San Francisco, that you're paying something. We think that's not fair. So we charge you nothing if your car is in the garage. But then, of course, if you're driving like a madman, or if you're driving, let's say, 3 o'clock in the afternoon versus 3 o'clock at night from point A to point B, and we, of course, have GPS, so we know what A and what B is, then, of course, we charge you. And that's unclear. It's just based on past data, not complicated models, whether we should charge you more at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when there are lots of cars around, and maybe the probability of an accident is higher, maybe not, I don't know, or 3 o'clock at night where, you know, you might have a couple of glasses of wine and, you know. So this is interesting. And the question I have for this company is, what about if I have an accident and my GPS device shows that I was speeding with 110 miles up at 280 at 4 o'clock in the morning? Will they say, look, you don't expect us to pay anything if you're speeding? So these are very tricky questions. And I think those companies which are transparent to the outside, not just internally building great regression models and, you know, telling you what they are charging you for your insurance, but being transparent to the outside in order to change behavior. It can't be changed on DNA, nothing much to be changed there, but it can be changed on driving. I think those companies are the ones which will not only be the ones which, you know, have a better social reputation, but ultimately will make society a better place by moving us to, you know, doing the right things for our health. All right, in that spirit, I thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
It was very stimulating. Thanks very much, everybody, for coming. And I'm not sure if there's still refreshments and food outside, but if there is, enjoy.
That's the reward for our attention.
There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, great.
Thanks, everybody.
Hey, does the name Jack Hakeem ring a bell to you?